On behalf of the World Affairs Council of Northern California and the Marines Memorial Association, welcome to today's program, Strategic National Security Challenges Facing the United States. We are pleased to have with us former director of the U.S. Office on National Drug Control Policy and four-star general, Barry McCaffrey. My name is Elizabeth Farnsworth. I'm a trustee of the World Affairs Council and special correspondent for the NewsHour with Jim Lehrer. It's now my pleasure to introduce tonight's guest. General Barry McCaffrey served in the U.S. Army for 32 years and retired as a four-star general. At retirement, he was the most highly decorated serving general, earning 3 Purple Hearts, 2 Distinguished Service Crosses, and 2 Silver Stars. He served as commander of the U.S. Southern Command, coordinating national security operations in Latin America. He also served as assistant to the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Colin Powell. After leaving the military, General McCaffrey served in the cabinet as director of the Office of National Drug Control Policy for 5 years. During his tenure, he coordinated a $19 billion federal drug control budget and developed the national U.S. drug control strategy. After leaving government service, General McCaffrey served as a professor of international security studies at West Point, where he continues as an adjunct professor of international affairs. He is currently president of his own consulting firm. According to the website, McCaffrey Associates provides, among other services, strategic planning support to clients, CEOs, board chairmen, and senior corporate leadership. He also serves as a national security and terrorism analyst for NBC News. Here to discuss national security challenges facing the United States, ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming Barry McCaffrey.
Thanks very much. Elizabeth, thank you for that very generous introduction, and I apologize for having this massive electronic device between me and you. Looks like Voice of America 1932 or something. I'm very happy to be here. Let me recognize a couple of people. First of all, my sister-in-law, Mary Alexander, past president of the American Trial Lawyers Association. If you're a CEO, you just flinched, I know. Brilliant woman and done a lot in the national legal arena. My brother-in-law, Skip Faulkner, a veteran, combat veteran of Vietnam, 101st Airborne, went on to a successful career here in San Francisco, which was capped because every time they'd promote him and try and get him out of San Francisco, he'd say, I quit, I'm not leaving this city. So anyway, Skip, Mary, thanks for being here. Jim Golby, where are you with your father-in-law? Jim Golby, back here finishing a PhD program at Stanford, arguably one of the best universities in the face of the earth, going back to join the faculty at West Point, was one of my students a few years ago. And since then, he's added a family and 2 combat tours, a brilliant, dedicated officer, and I'm very proud of him. His father-in-law, Kevin, who's a Marine veteran, is here, and a retired member of the San Francisco Police Force. So thank you, sir, for your service in protecting the people of this city. And Mike Myatt came in to say hello just before we came out here, a lifelong friend, a terrific Marine, commander of one of the 2 Marine divisions in Desert Shield, Desert Storm, an adjacent division of mine, and somebody I have great respect for. Done a marvelous job, not only with the Marine institution he's running, but also as a active citizen here in San Francisco. And let me, target of opportunity, Captain Hanlon. Here he sits in the front row in uniform United States Armed Forces with 4 rows of ribbons. And, you know, occasionally I have to remind people, I have a son who's deploying back in Afghanistan here in June again. He comes out of brigade command, just finished a tour out there as a deputy brigade commander of a parachute infantry brigade. A daughter, by the way, who was also served 8 years in the armed forces. It's occasionally useful reminding our citizens, we've got the smallest army essentially since 1939. The year my dad was commissioned an infantry second lieutenant. Many of these soldiers, sailors, airmen, Marines, Coasties, are now running 3 to 9 combat tours. We've had 47,000 killed and wounded. Some of these battalions that deploy out there are taking casualties at 20% to 30% of the battalion while deployed. The fighting in Fallujah, the second takedown. We had 1,100 killed and wounded in 4 days. So, you know, occasionally it's worth reminding ourselves of the enormous sacrifice that they've stepped forward to make. And we have great respect for them. They're part of the most trusted institution in American society. By the way, it's not a good statement for democracy to have to make, because the levels of trust in many of our governmental institutions have dropped dramatically over the last several years. But if you will, how about joining me in a round of applause for Captain Hanlon and the other members of the Armed Forces? Normally, since I've been teaching up at West Point here for the last, I guess it's pushing 8 years, it's always 50 minutes. There will be a short objective test at the end, and there's always slides. So here's the slides, and I think we'll dispense with them. You might want to get a copy. I think they're online at the World Affairs Council and skim through them. There's some. I keep it updated with numbers. I've been privileged since I left the government in 2001. I came out of the Armed Forces in 96, went to teach at West Point. I had a seminar, young people like Jim Golby, for better part of 5 years, continued as an adjunct professor, and I've used that hat to explain why I'm looking at international security issues or domestic security as a faculty member, nonpartisan, objective, and hopefully informed, and then try and come to conclusions, testify to Congress, back brief the departments of government that are involved in security, and try and inform the American people with an independent viewpoint. So in and out of Iraq, Afghanistan, mostly on a yearly basis, Cuba, Mexico, Colombia, Russia, I try to pay attention to weapons of mass destruction as an issue. In fact, I'll just suggest to you up front that the dominant security issue that you and I face as Americans is how do we contain what could be the continued proliferation of these weapons. I spent much of my life focusing, and all of us were nuke specialists from the time I was a lieutenant on, but certainly focusing on the chemical and biological threat. And I just tell you, up front, there is no question that not only have we gone from a situation, the confrontation, the Warsaw Pact and NATO had two generations of surprising stability with an immense potential for the utter destruction, Armageddon, of much of the face of the earth. We were prepared to fight a global war which included the use of nuclear weapons from the start. Fortunately, it didn't happen, and we've diffused that conflict. The consequences would have been literally a world-ending. Now we're in a situation where when you look at North Korean nukes or the Iranian nuclear program or Pakistan or India or any one of the 30-plus nations who could rapidly go nuclear, we recognize that there is a much higher probability of these being employed with a much lesser impact on mankind. But so we're looking, just take the Iranian situation to start with. I would assert categorically there'll be in a situation within the decade where they'll have 30 nuclear devices, the delivery systems to employ them, and that reality, which is emerging in the region, is causing you to hear Sunni Arab peaceful uses of nuclear power, which is stage one to going nuclear. And none of us will be well served. If these weapons proliferate, they will be employed. And the North Koreans, we think, have maybe the unclassified figures, maybe 8 nuclear devices. First two they tested fizzled on them, but fizzled means multi-hundred kiloton yields. They've got the systems to put at risk currently, no question, South Korea, Japan, China, U.S. naval forces at sea. So we're seeing the proliferation of these devices. Now, I would add, if you can make beer, you can make unstable, poorly weaponized VX nerve agent. And by the way, if you've got a third-tier university biology lab, you can make fairly reliably toxins or pathogens that represent a threat to human life. And by the way, chemicals don't work very well as a weapon. Chemical warfare is much less of a threat to a tactical force in the field than artillery fire. The U.S. Armed Forces can operate in a chemical environment with nearly the same effectiveness that we do in a non-chemical environment. That's utter misery. A couple hundred people might get killed. So it's not a desirable end state, but we have created a deterrent capability that's simply awesome. It doesn't make much sense to employ a GB sarin agent against a U.S. heavy division in the field, but they are extremely effective terrorist weapons. And indeed, you know, we saw one, we think, we hope we understand, that it was one mentally disturbed research PhD at Fort Detrick that made on his own, after hours, weapons, what we were classifying at the time as weapons-grade anthrax. Didn't kill many people. I think it was maybe eight. But it caused huge impact throughout the American system. There's the principal challenge to our national security. How do we create, and by the way, the solution is never military. You can't get the Iranians to not go that route by threatening them with two carrier battle groups carrying out conventional attacks. You know, 72 potential nuclear sites up there, we say unclassified. Who knows if it's 106 or if those 72 are really the places. And by the way, if you go after them with conventional air power, if you ask the U.S. Air Force to do it, and if the Iraqis and the Saudis let us bed down 1,000 aircraft and we did a 6-month campaign, we could wreck the Iranian industrial capacity to make nukes. Not going to happen. That's not the solution. So we're really talking, how do we craft political, diplomatic, and intelligence actions that can create barriers to make this process either less likely to spread or less likely to be employed. One of the reasons I would add, and it's worth a discussion, why I'm one of the few people who's a military background who totally supports anti-ballistic missile defense. You know, not Star Wars level, but enough to add a deterrent capability. When we talk to the North Koreans who are pouring their scarce resources into developing nuclear weapons, we say, look, here's another argument for you to not go this route. We will clearly knock them down as they come out of the atmosphere during the launch phase. And if that doesn't work, we'll get a mid-course with Navy Aegis cruisers. And if that doesn't work, we've got strategic ABM capability up in Alaska and, you know, one tiny capacity and one system at Vandenberg, and we'll hit them on the terminal phase. We got to have ABM. We got to give our arms control negotiators something to do to tell people this is not a course of action that's going to pay off for you. Hadn't worked. And by the way, if you're an Iranian lieutenant colonel in their intelligence service and you think this is absolutely going to put the Persian Empire back in a commanding position, one of the other dangers to that is if you represent a nuclear threat to our allies, or to certainly the defense of the continental United States, we're going to spend a lot of money developing an intelligence system to find your weapons, find the launch vehicles, identify the command and control, the political release authority, and then we will target you. And we'll brief 4 times a day the status of your weapons systems. And if there's some horrible congruence of events a decade out, somebody in the National Command Authority will have to take into account if a U.S. carrier battle group gets nailed in the Indian Ocean and 5,000 sailors have been killed and we see a weapon system at H-1 in holding, somebody will walk into the commander-in-chief and say, we recommend a preemptive nuclear strike. You don't want to be there. So the question is, what are the diplomatic, political, intelligence, and economic tools we're going to employ now to make sure that doesn't end up on the table? Weapons of mass destruction. Some comments about the ongoing wars, and I think we can leave this because all of you follow the Iraq and Afghanistan. You understand the geography and the people and the history of it. And, you know, by the way, you used to amaze me. I was the strategic planner for the JCS for a couple of years, and I'd go up every semester to Harvard and talk to the Kennedy School, and I was up there giving a lecture. I was sort of the lead guy on the Balkans at the time. The Balkans, poor Tito had died, the thing was unraveling, and I was being completely torn apart by a hyper-aggressive Air Force lieutenant colonel in civilian clothes. And he was leading questions were all, did I understand this, did I understand that? And I finally said, look, friend, there is nothing I don't know about the Balkans. I've been over every square foot of it. I've met all the people. I've read all the intelligence. I've read the history. The only thing I don't know about the Balkans is what to do about it. So if you have any suggestions along those lines, be sure to share them with me. And we're in that situation to some extent, certainly in Afghanistan. Iraq, let me just tell you, 36,000 killed and wounded, $800 billion perhaps spent, a flawed entry into that operation. The American people decided they weren't told the truth. One way to mobilize public opinion is to say the primary reason for action is to deny a nuclear threat to the United States, and it wasn't there. By the way, I think all of us were shocked there wasn't a substantial chemical capability there. So we got in there, and we ended up with a civil war welling up around our ears, and it was a flawed initial operation. You know, we know how to do those sorts of things, and I blame poor Mr. Rumsfeld for a good bit of that. You know, a guy of tremendous intellect and older and wealthy and charming in small groups with appalling judgment, and we got ourselves in trouble. Now, I think what is the case, in my view, is that it looks like the courage and the creativity of a handful of diplomats and CIA officers and a lot of soldiers and sailors have probably produced a situation where we'll be almost entirely out by the end of 2011. Maybe a few thousand intel. If they're smart, they'll ask for the Air Force to stay. They do not have the capability, nor can they create it to defend their own airspace. But I think we're going to come out, and my guess is probably the civil state will hold together. You know, their six neighbors have, I think, all concluded they are not served by all-out regional war. And no one side thinks they can really pull it off. If they did, they might try. You know, the Shia, the underclass, with the boot on their neck for a better part of 200 years. Sunni, maybe they're only 16% of the population. Nobody really knows. A small part of the population. The Kurds will never let an Arab set foot in that Kurdish area. The Iraqi army will never again go north of the current line. My guess is that they're going to pull it together. Maliki and his successors. And by the way, my definition of success is they don't attack their neighbors, they don't commit genocide against their own people, and they don't make nuclear weapons. So if we satisfy those three goals, okay, we come out of it all right. Afghanistan, tougher, really tough. You know, there was a tremendous political argument for a punitive expedition into Afghanistan. They killed 3,000 people, and they were, by the way, mostly Saudis, educated middle-class Saudis, but clearly the command and control was in an ungoverned space of Afghanistan. And so I think the entry in there was the appropriate thing to do. The heuristic benefit of smacking a hand that had dealt us such a huge blow. And you've got to remind ourselves, that was the most Americans killed on a single day since the Battle of Antietam. And it was a miracle we only had 3,000 murdered. Should have been 15,000, except for a couple of fortunate events and a lot of courage by the New York City, in particular, first responders. So we went into Afghanistan, but we violated a lot of the rules of warfare. You know, we've got principles of war, and one of them, I might add, is my principle of war is the U.S. Army never goes anywhere they can't walk down to the sea and a Navy ship. And we're 800 miles from the ocean. You know, we put the Navy carrier flight ops over Afghanistan. It's two air-to-air refuelings getting up to your target area. And 94% of the logistics comes through the portal of Karachi and up through the Khyber Pass on jingle trucks. And were it not for the U.S. Air Force and the C-17, we couldn't maintain our force in Afghanistan. We got 100,000 troops on the ground, 50,000 NATO. We're a long way from the ocean. And we're dealing with a country that, again, this is tribal warfare, the Pashtuns against the Hazaras, the Uzbeks, the Tajiks. They've never had an effective central government. The Taliban are the Pashtun. The army that we are creating, a couple hundred thousand, includes some Pashtun. They are not the southern Pashtun. We cannot deal with sanctuaries. And by the way, I think it's grossly overstated to say the problem is Pakistan, Baluchistan, Waziristan, the Northwest Territory. It's nonsense. The problem is the Pashtun fighting against, or fighting to regain control of the country, essentially. And so it's going to be a tough one. This fellow we've got in there in command, Dave Petraeus, I've watched him since he was a captain. I think he is probably the most talented person I ever met in my life. And the first team's on the ground. We got 5 ambassadors in the embassy, 1,000 people, USAIDs in there. We got money, we got energy, we got optimism. We got 4,000 killed and growing. We'll see how it comes out. The problem is we don't have much time left. The American people have written that off as a, particularly the recession, the sort of the twin imperatives of the recession and the war. We're running $8, $10 billion a month right now in Afghanistan. Height of Iraq, we were running $12 billion a month. You know, I've been here in California working transportation issues. You know, we need water down in the 2/3 of the California people in the South. But it's a $10 billion bill to do the conveyance, besides the other challenges. Well, that's 1 month's burn rate in Afghanistan. So the time isn't there. Obama, I think, appropriately kicked the can to 2014. That means he's saying, if you reelect me, we'll fight for another 6 years. And I don't think the American people want to give him that much time. Final comment, and then we'll open the floor to questions. Homeland Security, the toughest single challenge, bar none, I would suggest, facing us is, you know, this huge nation, 307 million people, highest per capita GDP in the face of the earth in history, 25% of the world's wealth or more created here, still dominant in most forms, we forget this, dominant in most forms of manufacturing, I mean, aviation, pharmaceuticals. Tremendous political leadership at municipal and county level. Greater opportunity here for equality and opportunity any place in the face of the earth. You know, 16 million foreigners stumbling around out there in the dark right now. Half of them came here by plane and won't leave. We run a roach motel. We'll check you in, but we don't know how to check you out. The other half came across one of our borders. You can drive across a 5,000-mile border with Canada, a couple thousand miles with Mexico. When I started working border control issues, there were 4,000 people in the border patrol. I started saying, you know, the right answer is 45,000 people. Each attorney general would say, General, what are the analytical underpinnings to your argument? There aren't. I made it up. Whole cloth. That's the size of the NYPD at their max strength. How could you suggest you could run cooperative law enforcement, not anti-immigrant operations, but cooperative law enforcement with a federal law enforcement agency that was clearly completely inadequate to the task? Well, we're moving in the right direction. We now, I think, got 18,000 Border Patrol, completely inadequate still. We need to solve immigration. If you're going to, by the way, the immigrants, illegal as they are, grow our food, run the meatpacking, construction, daycare centers, 98.9% of them are honest, hardworking women and men who came here for economic opportunity. For God's sakes, and both political parties' reaction is equally inane. We're going to track them down, wrap them in green tape, and send them back where they came from? We'd crash the economy. Both my grandparents came here to America from Ireland to Ellis Island drunk, and they did okay. I don't know. I think we've got a huge challenge. And now the other challenge in Homeland Security is we have to debate, where's the line between security and our freedoms? And we're redefining it. We're never going to go back to pre-9/11. It's over. We passed through the eye of the looking glass. At some point, we're going to have national ID cards. But we got to talk through it until we understand the downside. We want our law enforcement to be subject to elected political control. We want them to have to petition a separate branch of government to listen to our telephone conversations, enter our homes. We want them controlled. But we darn sure want to be able to ask somebody, sir, who are you? We want the Saudis to come here, use our school systems, our medical care, banking. We want to be open frontiers to foreigners. But we got to have some way of identifying who you are. We had some pretty good leadership. Tom Ridge, you know, the judge, Janet Napolitano, very young woman. She'll be around for another 20 years in public life. Met some pretty sensible people, built a new Department of Government, the third largest Department of Government, DOD, Veterans Affairs, Homeland Security. A lot of new things are happening. We are still not adequately protected. We're going to have to think through this. We're on the verge of another tragedy. These people are 44 terrorist organizations out there thinking through, how can we harm these people? And by the way, there's no threat. Southern California is 800,000-plus Muslim Arab population, 450,000 around Warren, Michigan, 250,000 around Northern Virginia. We don't hear of sleeper cells attacking us. You know, some family from Syria finds freedom of religion, work opportunities, the girls are in school, they can trust the police. This is a loyal population. Our problem, however, is completely inadequate ability to operate against foreign agents crossing our borders. And at some point, we're going to have to think through that. I would propose, madam, to end my remarks there. And I normally tell people that, you know, you folks paid a lot more attention to me than my family does. I'm on NBC TV periodically, and my two grown daughters are my substantive feedback loop. They use my cell phone, they'll call me and say, Dad, good makeup, good tie, good lighting, substantive feedback of that sort. And I got to tell you a true story. This actually happened a couple of years ago. I'd been on all day. I was in Secaucus, New Jersey, the nerve center of MSNBC at the time, and I had multiple interviews. I stumble off, it's 8 o'clock at night. My cell phone rings. It's my older daughter saying, Dad, us girls are here in Yakima, Washington. We loved your interview. I said, that's really terrific. Which one was it? I've been on all day. Dad, I don't know. We always turn the sound off. And on that note, let me thank you for your attention, and the floor is open and for your question.
Thank you, General. We've got some good questions. I'm going to ask the first question, though, myself. Some specifics. You mentioned that we have to craft political, economic, and intelligence actions to make, for example, it less likely that we would have a nuclear attack from Iran or from North Korea, or that we'd have to face that, even that possibility. What kind of political, economic, and intelligence actions do you think should be, let's start with Iran, then North Korea, we should be implementing or beginning that we're not now?
Well, if I can, Elizabeth, I'd almost back up and say that the challenge to proliferation is to not allow the weapons to be created in the first place. And once they're out there, we end up with 35 nations on the face of the earth that have these devices. It is my own judgment at some point they'll be employed. And a certainly good example is Pakistan, India. You know, I see both sides of that equation. I have immense respect for the Pakistani Armed Forces. An interesting country we ought to talk about. Not a nation, four separate nations under a weak federal state with the only load-bearing institution is the Army. And they're pretty honest, and they're pretty competent, and they're 99% of their creative energy is focused on India, the dominant threat. And if you go on the other side of the border, the Indians do the same thing. We got two nuclear armed powers. My view is we've come to open conventional warfare three times now. In the last several years, we almost went to another all-out fight. I think what will happen is if the PACs start losing with their lack of strategic depth and with their complete asymmetrical capability vis-a-vis the Indians, they will go nuclear. And it would be a catastrophe for the world. The same thing when you think about Israel and the Iranians. If the Israelis cannot, using conventional air power, go after Iranian nukes, can't be done. They couldn't put 2-3 squadrons over the target for more than 4 or 5 days. They'd run out of power. We'd probably stop them within that time. So that's not going to happen. But if the Israelis see their existential survival at stake, the only way they can respond is with what are purported to be their 300 nuclear weapons. You've got to create these international alliances that prevent the proliferation of these devices. And that's where we failed, because they are proliferating. And I would fear that we're going to see more of that in the coming decade.
Well, take Iran right now. What would you do to – are the actions being undertaken by our State Department, and are they enough?
Well, I think actually the both the Bush administration and Mr. Obama's team, Secretary Clinton, have done what they can to create alliances that will hem them in and wait them out. I don't think a conventional military threat is credible, and I personally think I spent half my life as a senior officer trying to strangle somebody's economy. And it never works. You normally impoverish the general population. The criminal element emerges dominant. The leadership still has flat screen TVs and perfume and cognac. So the economic isolation of Iran isn't going to work, particularly because the Russians, the Chinese, and the Indians aren't going to support it. They're not going to do it. There's too much competition for scarce, dwindling fossil fuel. So I don't think we're going to – I think we're going to see a nuclear-armed Iran that will be a huge problem, will place themselves at greater risk, and that our challenge will be how do we get the Russians to understand, as an example, that they're a far greater threat from a nuclear-equipped Iran than we are. In the short run, we're not a target. Secretary Gates appropriately said within 5 years it's possible the North Koreans would have a missile that could reach Guam, Hawaii, the West Coast. But in the short run, U.S. is not in great peril. But the regions are. And one of the reactions could be, well, then we better go nuclear, too. So I think it's political, economic, intelligence-related. It's new diplomatic endeavors. You got to have treaties that have bite to which people sign up. And I think Secretary Clinton's leadership has been pretty inspirational in the whole arena.
Okay, here's an audience question that's related to this. With U.S. anti-ballistic missile capability, launch detection capability, and overwhelming conventional and nuclear capabilities, what makes you think any country or group would undertake the suicidal step of launching or delivering a nuclear weapon against the U.S.?
Well, actually, if you ask me to do probabilities, I'd say it's an extremely low probability. The probability of a nuclear attack in the United States in the current regime in the coming decade is remote. And, of course, that's why we have to keep it. And you're talking deterrence. Deterrence is a function of a whole series of issues. One of them, it's painful to talk about, and we don't want to hear it now, is if we don't maintain a credible U.S. national nuclear strike capability, modernized, under control, trained, and ready, perhaps not the triad. Certainly, we've downsized the size of the nuke force tremendously. I was an arms control guy in Bush 41, and we've essentially gone from 20,000-plus nukes in Soviet and U.S. sides and reduced it dramatically. We saved a huge amount of money. It's easier to guard this stuff. By the way, the fissile material is harder to keep track of once it's out of the weapon than when it's in it. I don't think a nuclear attack is likely, but I also think that remains the number one threat. Could we be attacked with three nuclear devices off a barge, off a terrorist insertion, off of a very inaccurate North Korean missile? Of course. We have to take measures in technology and diplomacy and legal to make that unlikely. Now, let me turn it around. If I grab 10 of you by how intelligent you look out of the audience, and we constitute ourselves a committee to attack the United States with three radiological devices, and if we got a couple of million dollars, not much, so we could buy hotel rooms and rental cars, we would come back within a year with three radiological devices. They won't work too good. They'll kill a few hundred people max. They'll sicken a few thousand people max. They'll put into flight a few million people max. They'll have a cleanup requirement that'll go on for a few decades and a couple of hundred billion dollars. So there is a current threat that you and I have to take into account. And you could do it with medical fissile material, but it'd be better if you could get your hands on some of the hundreds of metric tons of plutonium and HEU that are floating around in several areas of the Earth, or if you got the North Koreans to help you, or the Iranians, or whatever. We just got the program, the Libyans turned over their nuke program. It was astonishing how far a third-tier nation had gone in preparing to make their own nuclear devices. We did it in 44. We didn't know if it could be done. So it's a caution, and it's something we have to talk about, and one of it's maintaining U.S. nuclear deterrent. It's an argument for our allies to not create their own nukes.
Several questions about Afghanistan. What can be done to replace the funding provided by the opium trade to the Taliban?
Boy, that's a, you know, I've been banging on those people every visit I went in there. You know, I remember talking to an unnamed allied two-star who told me, oh, come on, it's the poor farmers, and, you know, and the crops are dispersed and they're hidden among illegal cultivation. When you fly into Helmand Province and look out the, you know, window of a C-17 in the right season, you'll see Kansas wheat fields of opium poppy. We're talking thousands of metric tons of opium paste. Some of these numbers are soft. Half the GDP of Afghanistan is derived from opium. It's 94% or more of the global supply. They have killed the marketplace. There's, you know, when you look at opium, heroin opiate consumption, our country, we got a tiny number of heroin addicts, maybe 900,000. A couple million of diversion of legal opiates. 900,000, maybe we consume 13 metric tons of heroin. The Afghans, and by the way, most of that doesn't come out of Afghanistan, a couple metric tons maybe. Most of our heroin comes out of Colombia and Mexico. So you got hundreds of metric tons of heroin. Stockpiled, cached, it's killing people. You can follow the HIV strains in China through the drug trade. Thousands of Iranian border patrol guys getting killed. Devastating impact on the Russians. Russians are outraged. Why aren't you people doing something about that trade? It's very tough. I went in there and gave a lecture, respectfully listened to and not acted on, to Karzai. I've talked to our own senior people. Rumsfeld categorically said, we don't do drugs. We're not going to shoot at these poor farmers. We're over here to fight the Taliban, and we're going to ignore that aspect. And I tell them, hey, you don't take on the drug trade, we get run out of Afghanistan. It's, right now, if you look at Taliban units coming out of Balochistan, they're wearing REI camping gear, carrying shiny new sniper rifles with commercially encrypted telecommunications. You know, you go, you watch Mercedes-Benz traffic jams in Kabul. You see multi-story buildings going up in Mazar-i-Sharif. What do you think's doing it, stupid? Tourism? I mean, it's the drug trade, so you got to operate against it. There's three things you got to do. One, you got to do alternative economic livelihood. Everybody likes to talk about that, but it's hard work. You got to have USAID. only got 4,000 people in USAID. In Vietnam, they had 14,000. They're inadequately funded and manned. You got to do economic development. You also have to do eradication. If you don't tell a farmer who's living in a hovel and who can grow opium and get $10 a day working for the drug lords, you don't take that off the table. That's what he's going to do. You can go out there and tell me, no, you should be growing pineapple, and we're going to compete with Dole pineapple. You're going to ship it to Hawaii. This is all well and good, but there's an economic incentive to grow drugs. You've got to address that. The hardest thing you have to do is you have to have the indigenous leadership say, these drugs are killing us. It's foreigners perverting our religion of Islam. It's, you know, pick a number you believe. Somewhere between 1 million and 2 million Afghans are now drug addicted. Widows, soldiers. I was talking to a bunch of our company commanders, and they were talking about dealing with the Afghan police and said, sir, you know, our new TTP was no more smoking hash during planning meetings. We didn't say you couldn't smoke hash, not during the meeting. And so we got a huge drug problem in Afghanistan. The Afghan leadership has to step forward and say, this is a contravention of our culture. We've seen that happen. The PACs darn near eliminated opium production. And they got a lot of addicts, but they're operating against it. Thailand, a huge success. The royal family said these drugs, and it principally at the time was heroin, are destroying our society, and they're not in accordance with their own religious principles. So you got to have that leadership has to emerge. Bolivia did the same thing before my friend Evo Morales got elected as president. And now they're headed back toward coca production.
General, what did Karzai, President Karzai, say when you had this talk with him?
Like briefing Mr. Cheney or something, or
You know. A related question: why do we not, it seems, apply our Vietnam experiences in Afghanistan?
Why don't we apply
them? This is from a vet, Vietnam vet.
Well, you know, one of the things I spent a lot of time doing is denying any similarity between Vietnam and Afghanistan as strongly as I can, because some could argue, those of us who are veterans, that it's eerily similar to Vietnam, a national disaster, 58,000 killed in action, 303,000 wounded, the longest war until Afghanistan. It drew the country apart. Until the last one of us, 3.5 million veterans out of Vietnam, we're now the dominant veterans group. It was a disaster for the country. There's an art, by the way, we came out of Vietnam, my wife of 48 years, despised reporters, American politicians, and generals, and she ain't changed her mind on any of them since then. So we're in a very vulnerable position. We've asked the U.S. Armed Forces in Afghanistan to create a state, create an armed forces, create an operating economy, and come out by 2014. They're taking huge casualties doing it. A company a month gets killed or wounded. At the height of Iraq, it was a battalion a month getting killed and wounded. So I think... by the way, the competence, just as a comment, the competence of the armed forces right now is hands down higher than any period in U.S. national history. When you look at company commanders in the field and their troops, if you read War, Sebastian Younger's book, if you haven't read it, do yourself a favor, a quick read. He did a documentary 15 months on one of the parachute infantry companies up in the Coringal Valley. There's a documentary, it's also a real heartbreaker, Restrepo. If you haven't seen that, go see it. And so you got these kids out there now. They're on multiple combat tours. Battalion commanders are beyond belief. The NCO Corps is incredibly strong. We're recruiting volunteers from the top 25% of American males and the top 10% of American females. That's who's in your armed forces. They're essentially drug-free institutions to include the National Guard and the reserves, without which we would have collapsed 5 years ago. So the armed forces are remarkable, but I just took a delegation back to Vietnam. They did backflips. They were so happy to see us. We're the biggest foreign investor in Vietnam, bar none. They're desperate to get U.S. Navy ship visits. I did a lecture to 250 graduate students from the Hanoi area and faculty members, at the end of which I noted that they had asked me two questions about U.S. foreign policy. Everything else was about China. But on the other hand, we talked to the Veterans Organization. That war was a tragedy. They think they lost 2 million dead in 7 years of warfare. And I just told you what our losses were. Very bitter experience. Now, Vietnam, there's some eerie similarities. The domestic political argument, if you study Vietnam, the argument is you can do almost anything if you tell the American people what you're trying to achieve and say, here's what I'm going to do, here's what the cost will be, will you be with me? But you cannot conduct a war where the American people don't support it. That's the lesson of Vietnam, and that's where we are right now in Afghanistan, which is a shame. Okay, what other thoughts?
Sticking with Vietnam, which is probably pretty worried about China, I have quite a few questions from the audience about China. Comment on the Chinese stealth aircraft.
Well, I was just on CNBC a couple of nights ago, great furor over the, J-20 stealth fighter. It looks like a knockoff of the F-22, which I think a strategic error we made was to stop production. We got roughly 100 aircraft. We should have had 300 F-22s. Here's another argument. I'm worried about when my granddaughter is a two-star admiral, what will be the deterrent capability of the United States? Because the whole notion is not to get an effective fighting force. It's to build a force that makes less likely warfare. And so 25 years from now, I would suggest what we require is an air power and naval power capacity that is still two generations in advance of possible adversaries. The Chinese have a legitimate right. They're a global economic power. They're a tremendous economic partner. When you think about it, it just takes you back 25 years ago. It's astonishing that you can get on a plane, fly to Shanghai, and Chinese students are all over the United States. This is wonderful. And having a military that's appropriate to their national security interests is okay. But we want deterrence in the Western Pacific. And we're not investing in it. We're spending our money on 5.56 ammunition, fighting it out at 9,000 feet in Hindu Kush. We are in a strategic era of vulnerability, and we got to think through that. One of the things we do is we got to get out of Afghanistan at some point and just stop the burn rate of money and start modernizing our armed forces. We also don't want what happens in the military, I might add, whatever the majors think is they're eventually going to turn into major generals, and that's what they'll be doing is solving the problems they saw as a major. But we asked people like Bill Perry, one of the finest public servants I ever saw, probably the best Secretary of Defense in our history, a little quiet, modest, introspective, PhD in mathematics, drafty buck sergeant, thoughtful. We asked the civilian leadership not to help us with military operations. We know how to fight. We ask the civilian leadership to imagine the world that will exist in the future and to craft for us the political requirements and the economic resources to deter warfare. We've got these roles frequently reversed. We got a bunch of generals with cheap political science degrees and a bunch of civilians that are fascinated with company operations. It's a problem.
I'm interested when you list and when you talk about the main threats. China is not at the top of your list.
Well, first of all, I put it in context. I think you can make a strong argument the United States has never been in a more secure situation in our national history. There is no credible threat to our existential survival. It's highly unlikely. It's hard to imagine us finding a way to create a confrontation between China and the United States. The lack of wisdom on both sides of the Pacific Ocean would have to be remarkable to pull that off. But I do think that, of course, in the interim, we got a lot of people worried in the China Sea about the Chinese Navy, the Spratly Islands, seizing fishing boats, underwater exploration rights on gas and oil. And so we're clearly going to have to take those sorts of challenges into account. The way to deal with them, of course, is through dialogue and reason and logic, some of which has been sadly lacking in our national leadership in the last several years. But I think we're not going to end up in a confrontation with China, I pray. The J20, some of this is nonsense. I had some professor on air with me, a very bright man, a specialist in Chinese national security policy, who said they already have greater military potential than we do. It's complete nonsense. The most powerful air force in the face of the earth, bar none, is Marine Corps aviation, followed by U.S. Naval Aviation, followed by the U.S. Air Force. So, and it's complete nonsense to make those kinds of assertions. Never mind, our nuclear deterrence so far is still credible. So we need to engage the Chinese, and that was an embarrassment to President Hu. I don't think he knew about it. You know, it was technicians did this, and we had no idea. It's nonsense. By the way, you notice how when they first spotted that 4 days ago, it was a taxi test, and all the pundits said, you know, the thing's probably cardboard, you know, with an electric motor in it. And then 4 days later, it took off. So
you're saying the political leadership may not know what the PLA, the Army's doing?
I don't think they do. There's all sorts of indications that they have had provocative acts. Bouncing our Navy P-3 was completely illogical. Shooting down their own satellite was just incredible. They put a mass of junk into space, and we believe they did it without the knowledge of their own political authorities. And now the J-20 test coming on the day Secretary Gates got there. By the way, thank God for Secretary Gates. You don't have to agree with everything he does, but this is a world-class person of intellect, integrity, and experience. We're fortunate we got his leadership.
We're going to turn to Mexico in a minute, but we have a couple of questions about your own role as an analyst. You were skeptical of the Iraqi surge. Is it true, first of all, and how do you feel now?
First of all, Dave Petraeus, I have to always guard when I see Dave Petraeus, what I think is I could, you know, if I spend an hour with him, I'll come out singing in Swahili or he's... Dave makes the Army uncomfortable. He looks better than we do. He can jump over high hedges. He speaks multiple languages. He has a PhD from Princeton. He's a remarkable talent. And I think what happened in Iraq was we had an appropriate strategy, actually. We were trying to get out of there, stand up the Iraqi military and get out of there. But we had inadequate power. Dave got on the ground. He sensed all you had to do was talk to a battalion commander. We were in a huge pickle. We had a Shia-Persian frontier along our lines of communication. We were 500 miles into the middle of nowhere. We were taking 1,000 casualties a month. It was a very tricky situation. So the big change was Petraeus' leadership. He said, and it was a tremendously courageous thing, we're going to turn around and fight. We're no longer withdrawing. So he took U.S. Army and Marine Corps and Special Ops. He broke them up in platoon-sized units, put them in an Iraqi police platoon, Iraqi Army platoon, put them in downtown Baghdad. We took 3,000 killed and wounded in the space of 6 months. And our troops defeated an urban insurgency in an Arab city of 6 million people with no street addresses. It was unbelievable. And it was a combination of courage and tactical excellence. And part of that was we sent 5 additional brigades to Iraq, a tiny part of it. But my concern was, and they stayed for less than a year, so my concern was it was unsustainable. At the point, we had 44 brigades in the U.S. Army. We had 24 of them deployed. We can't make it work. And so our recruiting efforts, we were taking some pretty significant casualties. For a couple of years there, we started bringing in some 10% of our military army troops shouldn't have been in uniform. The Vietnam veterans, we all saw what happens when you get the wrong people in uniform and they turn into sergeants or officers, you end up with My Lai. So I don't think the surge was central. I think Dave Petraeus's leadership and the courage of the American servicemen who carried out the campaign was instrumental. And plus, I think the other thing that happened, it was so miserable to be an Iraqi mother during the height of that operation. It was appalling. We were talking about 60, 70, 80 murders a day. We were running 3,000 IEDs a month. It wasn't a couple of hundred. It was thousands of them a month. And so I think the other thing that happened was the country got scared. And the surrounding neighbors started to look at this and said, oh, my God, you know, at some point, this is going to be a regional war. Does this serve our interests? So I think when you want to thank somebody, thank a service member, thank Dave Petraeus, and thank God we pulled it off. And I think we have.
In your role as an on-air analyst, your views are respected because of your impressive military credentials, but you also have a financial stake in promoting certain views. How do you reconcile this? How does the public know which hat you are wearing?
Yeah, well, I've been stalked by the best. I think the story went nowhere. Obviously, many of us in the media should always be transparent. You should never on air as a commentator make recommendations if you have a financial interest in them, period. And NBC is a world-class news organization and would not tolerate that.
So you didn't do that?
Of course not. Of course not. It was ridiculous. If you hear me arguing for the F-22, it's not because I have a financial interest in it. And if I did think I had to argue for an issue in which I had a financial interest, all I have to do is disclose it or recuse myself. But that was complete nonsense. By the way, it was also, there was an anti-military tenor to that that was appalling.
You're referring to the New York Times article in 2008.
Or whatever. you know, would that apply to somebody who was in the National Institute of Health, had been the Attorney General? I think what would apply is if you're on air, radio, TV, the media, you should disclose anything in your background that could potentially bias your viewpoint.
Did you change anything about the way you did this work, the various work that you do?
Well, I ran out of energy, and I'm off three of the boards. That's significant.
Okay, turning to Mexico, we have about 5-6 minutes left. There are quite a few questions about Mexico, and you didn't get to touch on it much. In the next 2 years, will the U.S. Army be openly in Mexico? It's a provocative question.
Yeah. I've been watching the Latin American issues for years, since I was a cadet. You know, my class, Jim, we had two electives in 4 years, a really exciting set of choices. And both of them in Latin American affairs, and I took Spanish, and I've served all over Latin America as a captain through four-star general, and I love the culture, and I would also argue, and if you talk about the two most important countries on the face of the earth to the United States are Canada and Mexico, that's it. Canada's our number one trading partner. Mexico, depending on how you run the numbers, two or three. We have essentially almost free movement, legal or illegal, of goods, services, people, and ideas. When you look at the United States, the only foreign language you can speak throughout the nation and live adequately without a word of English is Spanish. So take it out 25 years, we will be the second biggest Spanish-speaking nation on the face of the earth. Mexico, 105 million people, tremendous culture, hard work, humility. Their senior leaders, by the way, it sounds like I always sound like I'm joking on this, are better educated, better dressed, and better looking than our senior leaders. They're world class. You know, they'll have degrees, and the finance minister will have a degree from MIT or Oxford. So they're remarkable people, and our future is wrapped up in their success. The problem is, and by the way, if you look at Mexican businesses, you can do business over the phone. They'll do what they say. There's no better friend to have than a Mexican family. Their music, their culture, their language, their literature are world class. The problem is their institutions, with the exception of the Army and the Navy being the Marine Corps also, Their institutions don't bear loads well. They're either incompetent or corrupt or intimidated. And so this President Calderon, a man of tremendous integrity and courage, is limited. Remember, this thing turned from Zedillo, who broke the chokehold of the PRI. He was a PRI political operative, but he gave Mexico a chance at open democracy. And Fox, there's no consensus on how democracy works yet. Fox moved it forward, and now Calderon said, we're going to try and institute the rule of law. Impunity to criminal conduct is the major problem. The local police are almost completely no longer in the exercising law enforcement power. State police, many of them are uniformed criminal organizations. And so without and there was no federal police force to speak of. So Secretary Genaro Luna, I'm on the advisory panel on drugs and crime to the Mexican government, is trying to build a federal police force. And I think he's up to 4,000 now. And he's now trying to get college-educated boys and girls and pay them an adequate salary and give them life insurance and so that there's some incentive to not be immediately corrupted.
And how serious is the problem? I mean,
it is beyond belief. And both governments officially are in denial of it and don't want to talk about it, don't want to recognize it. The Mexicans, you can understand, because they're worried about foreign direct investment and tourism. And so they obviously don't want to spin this in public, but their economy was crashing. In the last three quarters, we've seen some improvement. The oil industry, they badly managed their oil production. They got to go offshore drilling. They don't have the technical expertise to do it. They need Brits or Americans or Venezuelans or Russians to help them with it. So I think we got a problem. 35,000 murdered in 4 years. Downtown Juarez, 4,000 murdered. Across the river, same population. It's all Mexican-American, Mexican, across the river, El Paso, 4 killed in March. I was down there for a border conference. I just went down again. So across the border, and it's not just the border communities, Monterrey, the business capital of Mexico, tremendous levels of violence. Acapulco, 19 murdered, 6 of them stuffed in a taxi cab.
And how much is the U.S.? How much are we to blame for this we buy the drugs?
Well, two observations. First of all, we owe the Mexicans a serious level of support. The Merit Initiative, not a bad initiative, $1.6 billion over 3 years. Burn rate Afghanistan, $8 billion a month. So I would argue strategy is an architectural concept and the resources. We don't have the resources to help Mexico that are appropriate. We got to help them build a federal police force. It's going to take them 15 years. We're heavy on criticism. They're using the Navy and the Army to sustain the state. What would we have them do? Mexican ambassador is this brilliant young guy, Arturo Saracan, known him for years. There was massive media criticism. They captured 9 druggies. They took them to a military post and held them in the military post. And he said, Barry, what would you have us do? We could put them in the criminal justice system. They'd be gone that weekend. So we haven't publicly stood with them adequately. And then I think finally, there's a hypersensitivity and almost a hypocrisy on both sides of the border. The Mexicans don't want to identify and recognize the problem adequately, but they are trying to establish the rule of law. And on the American side, the public ignorance and the arrogance with which we deal with on the north-south axis is just astonishing. These are wonderful people. They're important to us. They're important to our economy, and they deserve our support.